Great. Thanks for having me. So today I'm going to talk about some work kind of asking questions quantitatively about how statistics that we measure in our Hubble patch might correspond to statistics in the rest of the, if the universe is very large compared to our Hubble patch, if inflation lasted a very long time, how do we make correspondences between what we see and what a super observer can see? So I'll be more specific about what I'm going to talk about. But I just want to say that this is work that's done in collaboration with Elliot Nelson, who's a graduate student at Penn State, and Sarah Chandra, who's faculty there. And at the end, I'll talk about some things that have been in progress, close to being finished, with Wayne Hu. So the idea is that the main reason that, the main method that we have to learn about inflation is by studying the statistics of scalar curvature perturbations in our Hubble patch. And the question is, we only observe the statistics of the curvature perturbation zeta in our Hubble patch. So how might these locally observed statistics relate to the globally defined ones, which might be what you predict from your inflationary theory? So the outline is, I'll first discuss how the local and global statistics are related. Then I'll give three examples of types of statistics for the curvature perturbation and how the local and global mapping works for these three examples of statistics for zeta. And then I'll talk about how this would actually work within a particular inflationary model, which is the curvaton scenario. So why do I care about this? Well, inflation is probably inflation or something like it is the best theory that we have for how the structure in the universe arose today. And the idea is that quantum fluctuations during something like inflation were at some point converted into fluctuations in the scalar curvature. And these curvature fluctuations are what give us the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background, fluctuations in the matter density, and the abundance of galaxies. So all this stuff that we have around us today, we hope that we can use to learn something about this early period of the universe. So examples of specifically what I mean by statistics of the curvature perturbation are looking at something like the cosmic microwave background and studying things like the power spectrum. So here are some examples of statistics that I could do with this, which is I could make a histogram where I bin up all the values of a field here and get some one-point probability distribution function. Or I could take the two-point correlation function or its Fourier transform, the power spectrum, and plot out how much power there is in fluctuations on different scales. And this is precisely what's done with cosmic microwave background data, for instance. Take a map of the anisotropy in the sky. Is this causing problems? Okay, can you hear me? Okay. From maps of the anisotropies, the cosmic microwave background anisotropies, you can take a power spectrum, undo the post-inflationary evolution of the acoustic oscillations and so on to recover the primordial power spectrum, and then do things like find infraquantum potentials, which are consistent with generating this power spectrum. So then the question is, well, how do the statistics that we observe in our Hubble volume relate to what you actually predict from inflation? So first of all, what's this variable zeta that I keep talking about? Well, by zeta, I mean fluctuations in the scalar curvature, which can be written as fluctuations in the expansion history.
Turn it around.
What's that?
Turn it around so it doesn't run. Then you put it in a collar.
Sorry. Is that better? Does that work? How about now? Can you hear? Okay. Okay. So this variable zeta is describing fluctuations in the expansion history relative to some average. And the point is that observers with access to different patches will see different average amounts of expansion in these different regions. And so what they define as fluctuations can differ slightly between the two regions. But a super observer who has access to this whole region can describe what a local observer here sees as fluctuations about their average and what this observer sees as fluctuations about their average. So the super observer curvature and the curvature fluctuations seen by the local observer are just related by these differences, where this here is the average over the region one, and this is the average over region two. So these local background averages are just some sort of constant pieces over here and are not local observables. So a couple of definitions that I'll be using in the next sections of my talk are defining these different definitions of the curvature fluctuation. So if this blue zeta is the fluctuations in the curvature that the super observer sees in volume, a larger volume, VL, then a local observer with access to this region, VS, sees zeta S, which is just the super observer curvature minus whatever the average over their background is. One thing to keep in mind is that if this is a Gaussian field, then their small-scale fluctuations seen here are uncorrelated with the long wavelength fluctuations or that background mode. But if there's some level of non-Gaussianity, then the small-scale statistics here, the small-scale field zeta s, can be correlated with this unobservable mode zeta l. In particular, there are ways in which if zeta s depends on the background, there's some local function of whatever this long wavelength piece zeta l is, then there can be a strong dependence of the local statistics on this unobservable background mode. And this idea might be familiar to you if you thought about scale-dependent halo bias, which is something that's been exciting in studies of primordial non-Gaussianity from galaxy surveys recently. But it was noticed that scale-dependent halo bias is essentially saying that the small-scale power spectrum varies from place to place in a way that depends on the long wavelength potential. Okay, so what are the consequences of this mode coupling? So the question is, what if our universe is small compared to the entire post-inflationary patch? And by small, I'm going to mean that this larger volume VL is exponentially larger than our Hubble volume, which I call VS. So the ratio of these two volumes being something like e to the few tens or more. So if that's true, and there's some level of non-Gaussianity in these statistics, then the small-scale statistics that we measure here, meaning the power spectrum, bispectrum, and trispectrum of curvature fluctuations, can depend on this unobservable background mode here, which we don't have access to. So it might be the case that what we see in our Hubble volume varies a lot compared to what observers with other typical Hubble, other Hubble size volumes end up seeing. And one way to think of this is that it's some kind of supercosmic variance. So the claim is that the local statistics of the curvature depend on some unobservable background. And you might look at this and think this is a fluctuation in the curvature, so it should be small, of order 10 to the minus 5 or so. And that's true, but the unobservable background is actually not just of order 10 to the minus 5, which is the typical amplitude of a single mode, but this long wavelength mode contains contributions from all modes with wavelength longer than the scale of our Hubble volume. So it's 10 to the minus 5 in each mode, but summed over all modes. So for an exactly scale invariant spectrum, it's boosted by a factor of n, the ratio of the two volumes. So where? This is dk cubed, and then this is, so for a scale invariant, but I guess this is not quite written right because this is dk cubed and I've written delta. So this, for a scale invariant, yeah, I guess this is pk normally.
Is that an implies to be consistent, there needs to be one over KQ.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, this should be PK, not delta, or this should be D log K right here. Thanks. So this background mode zeta L is some random variable, and it has a variance which we can calculate if you know what the power spectrum of fluctuations is on superhorizon scales, which we don't. But making some simple assumptions, you could estimate it. For instance, take the power spectrum that we see on our Hubble volume and extrapolate that to larger scales. And then we can describe this variable, zeta L, is just some Gaussian random variable that's drawn from a distribution, and the width is something that we can describe in terms of the power spectrum. So here are some examples of what you might guess. So this is a plot showing the typical amplitude of this background mode as a function of the number of superhorizon e-folds, or the ratio of the entire post-inflationary volume to our Hubble volume. If the spectrum of perturbations on superhorizon scales is exactly scale invariant, then you'd get this cyan curve here. So the typical size of that background mode increases, but just logarithmically with the number of e-folds. For a spectrum which is red tilted as ours is and exactly constant, you'd see this pink curve here where the power starts to increase much more dramatically once n sub s minus 1 times the number of superhorizon e-folds becomes of order unity. But that's precisely within slow roll inflation, this scale here where these things change dramatically is precisely when you'd expect higher order and slow roll terms to become important. So these are the dotted curves are some examples of making a guess at what the next higher order correction in slow roll parameters would look like. So a spectrum that ends up having an running, which is of order n sub s minus 1, could look like this, or it could bring it back to something that looks much more like scale invariant. So you don't know what this is. So in most of the plots in my talk, I'll show examples which are like this pink curve, which is the constant spectrum that we see in our Hubble volume extrapolated to large scales. But you should really not take that super seriously once you get to large n, because things could change quite a bit. So I'll also show comparisons for just an exactly scale invariant spectrum, that blue curve there. So you might get nervous as soon as someone starts talking about superhorizon perturbations, that's something that we just can't observe, and I completely agree with that. So these modes which are contributing to these large-scale fluctuations that change our local observables are not something that we can directly observe. So the curvature, even though we call this the curvature perturbation zeta, the physical curvature is really the Laplacian of that. So these really, really long wavelength perturbations, only the ones that vary a little bit across our Hubble volume actually end up contributing to anything observable. So the omega k, the local curvature density, has contributions from these, but only for k, which are sort of comparable to our horizon scale. And the fluctuations that I'm talking about that change our local statistics are only ones which are k is the wavelength of these is very long in comparison to our horizon. So this is not directly observable. Okay, so nonlinearity in this curvature perturbation can cause locally measured observables to depend on some locally unobservable random variable, which is these long wavelength modes. So the question is, how different might things actually be in different examples of initial conditions? How different could the local statistics you observe be from the average statistics that some super observer could see? So I'll go through just a few examples of how different types of non-Gaussian initial conditions could give rise to differences. So the first one is assuming that the curvature perturbation is described in terms of a single other Gaussian field, which I'll call zeta g. And here we imagine that globally the statistics are defined as some power series in this Gaussian variable zeta g, and there's one source, meaning one field zeta, the g that generates the statistics that we see. And this is weakly non-Gaussian in the sense that each of these terms is less important than the one before it. So the variance of this field is small, So higher order terms in zeta s are less important than lower order terms, is what I mean by weakly non-Gaussian. So way to picture this is that there's some field, zeta g, which is Gaussian. This, when this field is converted into curvature perturbations, the process of that conversion is nonlinear, and so the physical curvature that generates anisotropies in the microwave background and so on is some nonlinear function of that, and the local observables now are non-Gaussian because of the nonlinearity. So the more precisely, the in this case, where these higher order terms are smaller, the power spectrum is just related to the power spectrum of the Gaussian field. The bispectrum depends on the amplitude of this coefficient, and the trispectrum depends on both of those two coefficients. But on top, in a region where you have some, in a small Hubble size volume, the local statistics are different from the superobserver statistics because of these background modes. And if I just do a series expansion, you can see that the locally observed curvature looks like the global one, but there's some leakage of these higher order terms into the lower order terms. So the amplitude of the power spectrum has changed slightly, and the local bispectrum has also changed slightly. So the cartoon of that is that there's some nonlinear map that's relating these Gaussian fluctuations to what we see, this non-Gaussian fluctuations, but some observer that only sees this volume will define their perturbations with reference to that average, and then there's some, the local statistics here are biased, and the amount by which they're biased depends on this average over here. So you can work out how the local power spectrum and value of FNL and so on are changed, and they're changed by what you expect, which is terms that are higher order in this Gaussian field. So this term is a correction to the power spectrum coming from the bispectrum leaking in, and so on. But the form of this expansion is preserved. So you start with a series which is weakly non-Gaussian, and this series continues to be weakly non-Gaussian in the sense that the dimensionless skewness is small compared to one, and the dimensionless trispectrum is also small. So, but given a particular form of the statistics like this, you can work out the relationship between, there's some probabilistic relationship between the things that you measure at a local volume and the globally defined values of things like the amplitude of the power spectrum. And those two quantities are related probabilistically by, through their dependence on this unknown variable zeta L, which, in this case, is just Gaussian distributed. The variance, the typical size of these long wavelength fluctuations is something we don't know, but can depend on things like the number of superhorizon E folds. So these are different examples of probabilistic relationships between those two quantities. For 10 superhorizon E folds, there's less of a, the width of this probability relating the local power spectrum to the globally defined power spectrum is narrower than if you have very, very many superhorizon E folds, like 100, then different Hubble volumes will see a much larger spread in the typical size of local statistics. It also depends on the level of non-Gaussianity, and Planck has constrained, at least the bispectrum, Hendrick has constrained to be very small in amplitude. So the FNL value of something like 3 means that if these type of statistics describe the total post-inflationary universe, then there's probably not very much variation in the power spectrum, in the patch-to-patch differences between the power spectrum. That is, the probability distribution that relates the amplitude of power spectrum that we see to whatever the global average power spectrum is probably quite narrow, unless there's a huge number of superhorizon E-folds. The trispectrum is not so well constrained, so in principle there could be some large fluctuations relating some much bigger difference in the globally defined power spectrum and bispectrum from the trispectrum leaking in, but it remains to be seen what happens there. So now I'm going to talk about another example which just gives something that's much more qualitatively different in relating what local observers see to what some super observers see. So let's suppose something totally different, which is that the global statistics are described by just this simple polynomial. And so take a Gaussian field and raise it to some large power, but there's no linear term here. So the new distribution for this variable zeta is extremely non-Gaussian. You can calculate the power spectrum, the bispectrum, and the trispectrum. And unlike the previous case, all of these terms are the same order of magnitude. So all of the higher order cumulants are the same size as the variance, roughly. And that's what I would mean by calling this strongly non-Gaussian. You can see that in pictures by looking at the probability distribution function for this variable. If it's defined as zeta squared, then you get this blue distribution, which is super skewed. If it's cubed, or to the, then you get this distribution here with this really huge kurtosis. So these types of initial conditions are totally inconsistent with observations. They are not at all weakly Gaussian, but strongly non-Gaussian and inconsistent with things that we see. But let's look at what some local observer sees. So here, just splitting the local curvature into pieces that depend on small scale fluctuations, which you see vary within your Hubble volume, and these long wavelength pieces. In general, that's just doing some, just expanding this polynomial here. And in general, each of these terms is equally important. However, if you are in a region where the sum of all of these background fluctuations exceeds the typical size of the small scale fluctuations where you are, then in fact, this series is written and can be rewritten in a way that looks really similar to the weakly non-Gaussian series before. So I can change variables, and in a case where this term is large, each of these terms is decreasingly important, and you recover something that looks like this local, simple weakly non-Gaussian local form of statistics. So that's kind of interesting. I guess there are two questions which you can ask then. One is whether this is something that's physically reasonable and could happen, and the other is, well, you know, these terms, in our Hubble patch, these terms aren't just slightly smaller than this. They're actually much, much smaller. In other words, the constraints on non-Gaussianity are very, very good. So these additional higher order terms would have to be ridiculously small in comparison to the lower order terms. So it's actually putting pretty strong constraints. So first, what is this saying? This is saying that the contribution from long wavelength fluctuations is large compared to the typical size of small scale fluctuations on our Hubble volume. We can rewrite that in terms of number of superhorizon E folds and some subhorizon E folds. So if I have an exactly scale invariant spectrum for this variable zeta g, then in order for this to be large compared to this, this is a statement about the number of superhorizon E folds n in comparison to the number of ns, this number of subhorizon E folds. So this is just saying inflation has to have lasted for a really long time. And this particular relationship doesn't have to be quite so stringent if you have a spectral index which depends on wave number. This is just for the scale invariant case. Okay, so this can happen, but can you actually get something that looks as Gaussian as what you see in our Hubble patch? In other words, FNL is really, really small. And the answer is yes. So here I'm going to show some plots where I've assumed that I had some statistics which are described like this. So in other words, the entire post-inflationary universe is this very non-Gaussian place where on average I have very non-Gaussian statistics which describe the curvature. I want to see if I can construct local patches which look only weakly non-Gaussian that are in agreement with observations. So I want the local power spectrum to be of order 10 to the minus 9, and I want the non-Gaussian parameters to be small. So if I do with those constraints, you can ask, how often does it happen? How big does the universe have to be, and how likely is it to happen that you live on a local fluctuation which appears weakly Gaussian? So what's shown here, you can see it, is what I, if you, I guess, so one thing to keep in mind is that the observed fluctuations are of order 10 to the minus 9, which means that zeta g to the 2p is of order 10 to the minus 9. So these fluctuations, this Gaussian field zeta g has a much larger variance than the usual case that we're thinking of. Its variance is the square root of, so zeta to the 2g is, zeta g to the 2p is of order 10 to the minus 9. Requiring the variance of fluctuations to give us the small fluctuations that we see, and then ask what is the local value of FNL. So on this plot, this assumes that this field zeta g has a scale invariant spectrum on all on superhorizon scales. This is showing what the locally measured value of FNL is, requiring that I have these weakly non-Gaussian statistics as a function of the number of superhorizon E folds. So let's pick the red curve. I guess it's a little bit hard to see from back here. So the red curve is assuming P is 2. So the local statistics are just a Gaussian field squared. Then these curves, this is 1, 10, 100, 1,000. So for a very large number of superhorizon E folds, observers who live on, somehow seeming confusing. So I want the amplitude of scalar fluctuations to be what we see. And then I ask, what do observers who live on 1 sigma fluctuations in the background mode, 3 sigma fluctuations in the background mode, or 5 sigma fluctuations in the background mode, what do they see? So I need a large background fluctuation, usually, to see something which looks locally Gaussian. So 32% of observers will live on 1 sigma fluctuations in the background mode, whereas 0.3% live on 3 sigma fluctuations. But if I live on a 3 sigma fluctuation, then my local value of the locally observed value of FNL can actually be quite small. So for 100 superhorizon E folds, an observer on a 3 sigma fluctuation will see FNL of order 20, and for 1,000, it's more like of order 10, and so on. So observers on rare fluctuations, 5 sigma fluctuations, may see more Gaussian statistics. The larger the universe is, the more superhorizon modes are that can contribute to your local background, and the less rare of a fluctuation you have to be in order to see something which looks nearly Gaussian. They're all correlated. So I guess the point is that the local, so you need something like, I guess I should just start writing Planck now. So this number is of order 10 to the minus 9, and that's going to look like, I think that's right. So there is some relationship between this and this. And if the power spectrum is red tilted like we see, then it's much easier to get, if the power spectrum is red tilted, I have more power on large scales, and it's more typical to see large fluctuations, which could allow you to see values of FNL of order unity for fewer number of superhorizon E folds. But that we just don't know the power spectrum on superhorizon scales. The point of this is just that it's sort of a proof of concept, that you can start with something that looks very weird and get something which looks much more like things that are consistent with observation. So if you have a theory that predicts this, you don't need to discard it, depending on what you also think about how large the... Yeah. Yeah, so at the end I'll show an example of this, but I'm going to do this worked example with the curvaton at the end, and I think that it gives a picture. But in some sense, you're further from, your series expanding this.
You're saying mercury signal, you mean in the direction of lower and not Gaussian?
No, I just mean the amplitude, if the amplitude of this background is several sigma away, then you do tend to be more non-Gaussian because the local fluctuations
that, more Gaussian.
Because the local fluctuation, you're looking at fluctuations of a fixed size and with reference to some other quantity.
Number.
Yeah, and so the ratio of those.
So you're dividing by big numbers, but there's a bit smaller.
Yeah, yeah, in some sense. I'll show an example where it, I think it's clearer, and then we can talk more. So the point of this is just to show a few examples. The weakly non-Gaussian initial conditions stay weakly non-Gaussian. Strongly non-Gaussian initial conditions can look much closer to Gaussian locally. If you add more fields, allowing multiple fields to generate your initial conditions, you can get, not surprisingly, adding more fields allows you to get more general things in relating the super observer statistics to the local observer statistics. Actually, sorry, I remembered someone in the back had their, did you have a
question?
Okay. So I'm going to skip ahead on this for a minute, but if I allow multiple fields to generate my initial conditions, then there's more freedom in relating the locally observed statistics to the globally observed statistics. So these are the same plots as before, showing the probability of observing a given value of the variance of fluctuations, given the probability of a local observer giving a given observing a particular value of the power spectrum, given that this is the global observers, the globally defined power spectrum. And the more power I add from additional fields, the more this distribution broadens, and there's a larger mapping between the two cases. In some cases, you can also find that not only is there a large freedom in mapping global statistics to local ones, but sometimes you can get scale dependence that the super observer statistics could be strongly non-Gaussian and have some scale-dependent parameters describing the bispectrum, but a local observer could see something completely different. So these are examples having multiple fields where the probability distribution relating the globally observed value of FNL, the locally observed value of FNL to the global value here, and these probability distributions are super, super skewed. So while on average, observers in the whole universe, if you average over all of their volumes, as a super observer could, in this case, they would see an FNL value of order 10, but typical observers see, there's a large tail of observers that see very, very low FNL values because of this complicated mapping between the statistics. But I want to move on and talk about a particular example. So far I was just showing statistical calculations. Like I have some field that has a particular power spectrum and I define some quantities and then ask, what do the statistics, if I only measure some small volume, what statistics do I see in that small volume and how are they related to the statistics that some other observer would see? If you want to relate this back to how you inferences could change about inflation, there are a couple of questions. One is whether the way that I've defined, how this works in terms of what the local statistics actually are, what a local observer sees in terms of power spectra, in terms of the models. And the other is, what types of parameters does this actually change? What do you get wrong in relating these two things? So here's a specific example, which is the curviton. So the curviton model is just a simple two-field inflation model where I have one field, the inflaton, which dominates the energy density during inflation and drives the exponential expansion. But I have a second field, the curviton, which is light subdominant, so the energy density is just determined by the inflaton, but it's these fluctuations in the second light field, the curviton, which are eventually responsible for generating the curvature fluctuations that we see today. So one thing is that in this model, the amplitude of perturbations in the curvaton, which gives us our final observable curvature perturbations, is set by the Hubble parameter during inflation, which is just due to the inflaton. So when inflation ends, the curvaton might be sitting at some value, sigma star, and the final curvature perturbations are generated when the curvaton field decays from this value and converts fluctuations in the curvaton get converted into fluctuations in curvature. So here's one way to look at that is that the simplest approximation is to assume that the curvaton has an exactly quadratic potential and that the curvaton decays when the Hubble expansion equals some decay rate. I'll just call that gamma squared. So in this sudden decay approximation, I can determine what the fluctuations in the curvature or the local expansion rate are in different patches by comparing the Hubble rate and the expansion in one patch with the following value of fluctuation in the curvaton to Hubble rate in a patch with another value of the curvaton. So this gives me an exact nonlinear relationship between the curvature fluctuation zeta and the fluctuations in the actual curvaton. So if you work this out in this case, then what you find is that the fluctuations in the curvature are directly related to fluctuations in the amplitude of the curvaton, delta sigma, divided by the freeze-out value of the field over here. This curvature is non-Gaussian because there are these higher-order terms which are nonlinear in the field delta sigma, and delta sigma is a Gaussian variable. But the coefficients of these terms are just numbers, 5/4 and 25 over 12, and so on. So the value of FNL here is just minus 5/4, and GNL is 25 over 12. So if you ask, if I'm asking what the power spectrum is in regions with a common long wavelength fluctuation in sigma, I could just carry through all of these calculations again, but instead of having this value sigma star, it's going to be shifted by some amount delta sigma L. So here, a local shift in the long wavelength curvaton mode just shifts the power spectrum by some amount here, which ends up being can be written in terms of long wavelength fluctuation in the curvature zeta L. So what you see is that if you ask what a local observer with a different freeze-out value of the curvaton field sees and carry through the same calculation of the curvature fluctuations, you will find results that agree with the mode coupling calculations where I plug in the local value of FNL and the local value of GNL to determine the change in the curvature fluctuations. So in this case, you see that the local statistics, the numerical values of quantities like FNL and GNL aren't changed, but the amplitude of the power spectrum is changed. So sort of the level of non-Gaussianity is different in patches with different, with long wavelength modes. But a local observer would just interpret that as having ended inflation with the curvaton field at some other point. So all of that change is absorbed into the freeze-out value of the curvaton field. And that picture agrees. If you allow there to be radiation present when the curvaton field decays, then I have a slightly more complicated equation that relates fluctuations in the curvaton to fluctuations in the curvature, but you can carry through the same calculation. In this case, the amplitude of curvature perturbations depends not just on fluctuations in the curvaton field compared to its value at freeze-out, but also the amount of curvaton energy density and radiation energy density that are present when the curvaton decays. So there is a strong dependence on of the local amplitude of the power spectrum and the local values of non-Gaussian parameters. So here, FNL depends strongly on this quantity R, which is just the ratio of craviton to radiation energy density at the time of decay. So the reason that's relevant is that this is an example where the craviton, if the craviton is the only thing present at craviton decay, then FNL is exactly 5/4, so you have very weak non-Gaussianity. But in this case, you can get still weak but larger values of these non-Gaussian parameters by having this number R, the amount of craviton to radiation density, being small. And if you ask what a local observer sees in a long wavelength mode, two things change now. One is just this value, sigma star, of when the craviton freezes out. But that change in sigma star also shifts the value of craviton to radiation density at the time of craviton decay. So now you have a couple of shifts in the problem when you ask what different local observers see. But these expressions for how the local curvature changes are the same as what you would get, we found in the mode coupling calculation. So asking what value of curviton and radiation density a local observer has and calculating their local power spectrum is the same as taking the super observer calculation and asking how the small scale power spectrum varies from place to place depending on the average long wavelength mode, where this long wavelength mode shifts the reference value of curviton field and the parameter R. So the example, so that I interpreted this as just saying that as expected, this mode coupling calculations capture the dependence of quantities on the local background, which is what you would think. And in this example, all of this supercosmic variance, so different observers seeing different statistics, can just be related to changes in this sort of freeze-out value of this quantity sigma star. So in this particular example, the change in physical quantities just relates back to a change in initial conditions, in some sense, what this value of sigma star is. And moreover, I would say that, so in this case, you can also get a picture for how you could get statistics which look more Gaussian in when the global statistics look very non-Gaussian. So imagine that on average in this whole patch, the average freeze-out, the average value of the curviton field at the end of inflation is near zero. Then typical fluctuations in the curviton, which are determined by the inflaton, so the fluctuations in curvature are set by, you know, variance in this quantity across these local Hubble patches, then typically, the statistics would look very non-Gaussian. But in some regions, inflation lasts for a long time, you have this huge volume. There are some regions where there were many kicks of the curviton up the potential. And for fixed fluctuations in delta sigma, which are set by the inflaton, comparing the fixed amplitude of fluctuations to this reference value here, these statistics will look more Gaussian than comparing fixed amplitude fluctuations to this reference value. Yeah?
So even in single field inflation, if I look at really, really large scales, the distribution of the field value, say, or the number of people of inflation on, you know, super, super Hubble scales is also very non-Gaussian. Can you capture that with this formalism?
I'm not sure. So there is, so one thing that I've learned from this is that the people who are most interested in this are sort of eternal inflation kind of measure type things. And I would tend to think that this is a similar but simpler problem in the sense that I'm working in like one patch where there's a fixed number.
Eternal inflation, so if I give you lambda phi the Fourier theory,
yeah,
and I assume that initially, in regions initially separated by a Hubble volume are possibly separate in the initial conditions.
Yeah.
And then I just ask, what is the evolution of all these different Hubble volumes? And then I calculate the probability distribution, say, the
right
number of equals. That will be a non-Gaussian probability distribution.
Okay.
A very non-Gaussian probability distribution. But then, of course, that's not relevant because we're much smaller than that. So when you look at
right
the smaller patches, then locally it looks very Gaussian.
Okay.
We which sounds very similar to...
Yeah, this, I mean, I guess in some sense, I think this might be just a rephrasing of those things, where in this problem we're saying you have a super observer and you have this mode coupling calculation, whereas otherwise you might just say, well, I'm just going to restrict to these volumes where I have statistics. Is that... I mean, yeah, quantitatively, I'm not sure, but I think that sounds like... So does this help with that question about the Gaussian from more Gaussian from? Okay. Okay. So and another way of thinking about this is just, you know, these calculations are calculations of mode coupling with local type non-Gaussianity, and another way of thinking about local type non-Gaussianity is some strong dependence of local statistics on very long wavelength fluctuations, which in this case are just the background. So these making this comparison between a super observer and mode coupling calculations and quantities seen by local observers that depend on the background just agrees with this picture. Do you have anyways? So one other thing is that yeah, that's right. So in these cases where you have like a polynomial field, right, then a large fluctuation from zero means that you have a big linear term in that polynomial expansion, and then you see things that look more Gaussian, which corresponds to regions of the universe where you had many, many steps away from the minimum, and so these typical curvature fluctuations are small compared to the average.
I mean, you agree that this is model-dependent, but could I imagine
certainly the way gravity works, I guess, is that it generates long, more non-Gaussianities in overdense regions. But I don't know, I mean,
no,
yeah.
I guess the horizon over,
yeah.
I mean, like, a large region is a much larger zeta than average.
Yeah, this is not a, those are just a couple of particular examples. So in some sense, looking at this curvaton gives you some picture of how this coupling between statistics is happening, and how, and in this case, the difference between the local observer and the global observer just amounts to some difference of opinion on what the initial conditions were. And in all of these calculations, trying to find cases where you get non-Gaussian, you start with non-Gaussian statistics and get things which are locally Gaussian, I'm assuming that all of these different parameters, for instance, the amplitude of perturbations and the values of these couplings, FNL and GNL and so on, can be independently varied. But in a real model, that's not necessarily true. And this, these calculations are sort of related to some calculations that were done by Linde and others in this, what they call the curvaton web, where they work within particular set up for curvaton and inflaton, where the masses of those two fields are different in different places, and you get a large variation in what the types of statistics that local observers see, which is in some ways related to the calculations that we've done here. So I'll just wrap up. The summary is that even if there's some level of non-Gaussianity, there can be and the universe is large, then there can be a dramatic difference between local observations of things like the amplitude of the power spectrum and the globally defined values of those quantities. So to put it another way, one thing that you learn from these constraints on, strong constraints on local type non-Gaussianity from Planck is that given these small bounds on FNL, then there is less room to have a big change when you ask what the local power spectrum has to be compared to the global power spectrum. But we've shown a few examples where you can get these mappings between statistics that look very different on very, very large scales, and local statistics that all look similar to the ones that we observe. In other words, weakly non-Gaussian statistics with a power spectrum of order 10 to the minus 9. So in multiple cases, you can get the mapping between all of these statistics and the ones that we see locally is, in some sense, is kind of many to one. And then working that out in a particular case that shows that this local global mode coupling calculation does indeed capture what a local observer would be measuring. And if you want to see some, there are some more examples. There have been quite a few papers recently on this stuff by Sarah Chandra and Elliot Nelson, and also Chris Burns and others, looking at how the inferences about non-Gaussian parameters vary with not just non-Gaussian parameters, but also the amplitude of the power spectrum and the spectral index and so on, how that could be different in comparing the final post-inflationary patch to our Hubble volume. That's all.
Yeah. So you said eternal inflation, why people love this.
I don't know. Okay.
The reason is that there's an implicit assumption here, which is you're choosing to, your proxy for observers is a randomly chosen co-moving volume of a certain size.
Right.
Now, is that necessarily the right proxy? Because I can imagine other ones.
Right.
And so, you know, sure, it can be a proxy, but then in order to really turn it into a prediction for what might be more relevant, you have to then, say, compute, well, what are, you know, what's the number of galaxies in a co-moving volume of this size with these local values of the power spectrum, et cetera, and then see if that biases you in any significant way. Do you have any thoughts on that? Do you think it would? Like, how get almost, I mean, from this now we're saying, okay, locally in a Hubble patch, we can get any power spectrum we want. And we need to weight these possibilities, but then we also need to weight those by how many observers are.
Their probability distributions here are very well defined in terms of, I'm just saying that this is a random variable and I'm volume averaging, but in terms of talking about observations, there's no like anthropic prior that you have to be able to form structure or anything like that. And that's not something I've listened to, but it is. I've had some conversations with people about
but it is important, that. Right? And it's a good illustration of where you don't necessarily have a bunch of infinities lying around, which is the real hard measure problem.
Right.
Here you can make everything